I'd go get a ladder and I'd put the light bulbs in. It used to make them mad, but I say, hey, if not me, who? If not now, when? You're not here to serve me. I'm here to serve you. So whatever needs to be done, I'm not too good to do it. I'll clean bathrooms. I'll do whatever I have to do. And so they got to know me that way. And that made a huge difference because I lived my values.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Howard Bihar. For 21 years, he was the president of Starbucks North America. He joined back in 1989 when it was still a startup. And along with Howard Schultz and Orrin Smith, he was one of the key leaders that helped grow the business from just 28 regional stores to over 15,000 stores around the world. He opened the first store in Japan and led the international business. And then he spent 12 years on the Starbucks board after retiring. Through his career, the common thread has been about servant leadership. He's focused on defining it, practicing it, and teaching it in his books, in his speaking, and in his career. In this conversation, he talked about the early days building Starbucks, his working dynamic with Howard Schultz and Orrin Smith, and what he's learned about servant leadership from over 50 years of practice. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Howard Bihar. Hey, Howard, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask you about what it was like joining Starbucks in 1989, because 30 years later, it's such a force in the world. But as I understand it, it was a startup back then. What was the state of the business when you came in?
When I started, there were 28 stores. It was losing money. We were just starting to raise venture capital money from angel money. And it was a unique experience. It was a small company and with lots of energy and lots of passion for its product, but not without a lot of sophisticated leadership. And that was at the time Howard Schultz was starting to recruit people to come into the organization that had experience, had a few gray hairs, so to speak. I hardly had any hair at that time, but what I did have, it was gray.
And what was the response in the market at that point? Was it getting momentum quickly, or how much doubt was there in the future of the business?
Everybody thought that we were doing okay in Seattle. The stores were doing well, and the stores, for the most part, were cash flow positive. But everybody thought it's a unique thing to Seattle, northern climate, lots of coffee consumption already, and that it wouldn't translate. So when we went out to raise money, everybody's saying, is this really going to work in California or other places? And that's when we started to test the markets. We had a non-compete in the Bay Area, so we had to go to Southern California first. And we opened a first store in Southern California in Santa Monica. And it was actually a piece of property that Bill Cosby and his wife owned. And it was actually a great location on Main Street in Santa Monica. And it just blew the covers off the door. We'd put in this linoleum flooring that was good looking, but it wore out in 6 months. There were so many people coming through the door. We had no idea what was going to happen. And then California just took off like a rocket ship. People already knew about us because West Coast City, and we'd opened in Oregon already. But it really worked well until we went to San Diego, and it took us a long time to get it to cash flow positive. But when it finally did take off after about 10 stores, we never looked back.
What gave you conviction to come on board in those early days and join the business that is pretty unproven, especially outside of the Seattle area?
I was trying to buy a business. I really didn't want to join another company. And I won't go into the whole story, but I met Howard Schultz a couple of times. And the first time, we both agreed that it wasn't right for me. I wasn't right for him, and he wasn't right for me. And I was still trying to buy a business at that time. And the second time we met, I asked him if I could come before he extended an invitation for me to join. I said, can I come work for you for a week? Let me work in the company for a week. You don't pay me. I'll just work. I'd like to work in the plant for 2 days. I'd like to work in the stores for 3 days and on the trucks for 2 days. At the end of that week, if you like me and I like you, then we talk. And so that's what we did. And by the end of that first week, I knew it was right for me. I didn't ever know what it would become. I was, I loved coffee, and the business was a human business. It was less of, at least I figured out pretty early on that it wasn't about the coffee. It was about people. And that's what I drove within the company. But I turned right instead of turning left. Everybody looks back and say, God, brilliant. Oh, what great marketers there were. All those things that are just absolutely untrue. I was trying to escape corporate life, to tell you the truth. I thought this was going to be a little tiny coffee company, maybe west of the Mississippi. Never did I ever think that it would become what it became. And neither did Howard. He had bigger dreams than I did, but Orrin and I had small dreams. Howard had big dreams, and we caught on to his big dreams, but we didn't know. We were doing okay, and we struggled. We were negative cash flow, and some stores were doing well. Some markets did well to the gate. Other markets suffered for a long time, and we just stayed with it. We raised a lot of money early. We hired great people. And I'll tell you when I knew that we had something. It was but little after the first year I was there, there was a store in Vancouver, British Columbia, on a corner called Robson and Thurlow. And it was one of the old stores, but it was doing exceedingly well. It was doing about $1 million a year, which was huge for us. That was way above our averages. And it had a demolition clause in the lease that if the landlord wanted to move us out, and it was an old building, I was sure he was going to tear the building down because it was underutilized. The property was underutilized. And so I said to our real estate person, see if you can get that corner, kitty corner across the street from this one. Just trying to hedge my bets. I thought it'd take us a year to get it because it was a heritage building, and heritage buildings are hard to get and hard to get permitting. But she came back in 6 months and said, we had it. And I had to make a decision. Do I take it, knowing we're already on this other corner? And I just, to tell you the truth, I wasn't that smart. I just took the risk and flipped the coin and said, let's take it. And so if the worst thing could happen, we had to close the other store. And the day we opened the second store on Kitty Corner from the first one, we doubled the volume on that corner. We had not only one store doing $1 million, we had two stores each doing $1 million. And there were two different customer bases. One we called the bikers, the other one we called the suits. And that was about what it was like. And that's when I knew we really had something, that we were underserving. And that's when we really started to put stores close to each other. And that's when it really took off.
Yeah. What was it that caused that to work? And why was that such a pivotal point in having conviction in the business?
Well, it was obvious that we were totally underserving the market, that there was more demand for what we were doing than the store could handle across the street. And once we figured that out, we tried a few more of those where we started putting them close together, and they all worked. We might drop 10% volume for the first 6 months, and then it would go back up. But these two stores, it didn't do that. Volume never dropped at the first store. And so that was a huge signal for us and gave us a lot of confidence that there was a lot more market out there for us than we ever thought was possible. And that drove us to take more risks. And as we started open stores, these stores were throwing off so much cash. We were paying back our cost of build out in less than a year. We were getting in a lot of stores 100% return on our capital in a year. In those days, the cost was very cheap to open a store, less than $200,000. We'd get that $200,000 back in less than a year. So we were throwing off cash. And we didn't have to, we really only raised capital once or twice. We were throwing off so much cash that we didn't have to raise any more capital. We never even took on any debt till way much later when we didn't need it.
When you go back to that week where you were working with Howard, yeah, before you kind of signed up, was there anything you felt or experienced that really said, hey, they're onto something here, or this could be special?
It wasn't so much that I thought they were onto something from a business perspective. It's that the people were so energized and so excited. When I worked in the stores, I could feel what the customers were saying. I had been a customer for a long time, so I knew the business from the consumer point of view. But it just, the energy inside the building, the people were positive, and it kind of had a soul to it. It did have a soul to it. It was a coffee business. You weren't selling Cokes. You were educating your customer about the coffee while you were selling them coffee. In those days, 60% of our business or 70% of our business was retail, not beverage. We never saw the beverage. We saw beverage coming, but not to the extent that it took over, and it really did take over. But it was just that. I just attached to the people and the business right away. And I felt it was the right place for me, because I figured out earlier than anybody else did that it was about people. And I sensed that from that first week. And so that's what I drove in the company. I said, yeah, coffee is important, but it's the people that make this business go. And that's what we focused on.
When you came into the business, what did you do to start driving that focus on people? It's the story is infamous now, looking back. But what were some of the early steps you took to take that energy and keep building on it?
I was high touch. So I'd probably spent four of my days in the stores talking to customers, talking to the managers and the baristas. So that made a huge difference. I talked about the fact right out of the gate that I was trying to get everybody to understand what I was talking about. And so I came up with this little phrase that they still have used today, that we're not in the coffee business serving people, but we're in the people business serving coffee. I used to go to store meetings. We weren't open on Sunday nights in those days. And I'd go to store meetings where the baristas would be there. And I would talk about the fact that they were social workers. The baristas were social workers. And they had 10 or 15 seconds to figure out where that person was in front of them. Did they just want a hot cup of coffee or did they want to have conversation? And you had to determine. You had to use the antenna that you have in those your head to determine where they were and then have the appropriate real conversations. And I also felt that our business had to be about texture. And what I meant about that they were real human conversations, real human interactions, not like you're going to McDonald's and they say, would you like to have a large order of fries with that? I didn't want our people doing any suggestive selling. I just wanted them to be a human being responding to the other human being in front of them. It wasn't a customer-employee relationship. It was a human-to-human relationship. And that's what I drove. I just kept giving that same speech over and over again.
So tell me what it was like in those early days when you would drop in on stores and start talking to customers and talking to the frontline baristas. What was your process or what were you trying to learn when you do that?
I was trying to build connections. I was trying to build relationships. So I'd go in and the first person I talked to were the baristas after I cleaned the condiment stand. And I'd ask the barista, I wouldn't say, how's the store doing? I'd say, tell me about yourself. Where did you come from? How long have you been here? To try to and develop a conversation. And then they'd ask me questions about myself. And then I'd talk to store managers and I'd do the same thing. Now, after a while, I knew the stories of most of them. So it was only the new people that I would do that with. But I was trying to build human relationships. I was trying to do with them what I wanted them to do with the people they were serving. Be authentic, caring, ask human questions, be interested in that other person.
So can you go back and you cleaned the condiment stand? What is that about?
Well, if retailers, you don't walk in a store and see a piece of paper on the floor and walk by it. You pick up the piece of paper. I don't care what your position is. You could be, God should be picking up the pieces of paper, you know? And then the condiment stands, they're always dirty. Somebody just been at the condiment stand, spilled something on them. And so there was always a rag there and I'd go clean those up. I'd even put new light bulbs in. If I walked in a store and I saw light bulbs out, they got to the point where they knew, if they knew I was coming, the light bulbs were all in because I hated light bulbs that were out. I'd go get a ladder and I'd put the light bulbs in. It used to make them mad, but I say, hey, if not me, who? If not now, when? You're not here to serve me. I'm here to serve you. And so whatever needs to be done, I'm not too good to do it. I'll clean bathrooms. I'll do whatever I have to do. And so they got to know me that way. And that made a huge difference because I lived my values. I wasn't talking to come in the store and say, hey, you got paper in the store, go pick it up. You'd be surprised how many leaders do that.
Yeah. So here comes an executive president of North America at the time. You'd come in and clean up the messes the customer had left, change the light bulbs.
Whatever it took. And then I'd go talk to customers. I'd sit down at a table with a customer. I'd introduce myself and I'd ask them questions. I said, what are we doing for you that you like? What are we not doing for you? What don't you like? And I'd learned a lot that way. And after a while, you know, it worked.
What were some of the things that you took away from doing that so frequently? What would you do next, you know, after spending a bunch of hours in the stores? How would you bring that back to the leadership team?
Then I had my own little team and of people, operations, retail operations. I'd come back and talk about it. And I wanted them to do the same thing. So sometimes we'd go out together and we developed this methodology. That's how we did our research. You know, I always laugh about data. Everything's about data today, everything. I went and got my own. It was real and it was timely. And it's how much data do you really need after you talk to a dozen customers or a dozen baristas? You don't need millions of pieces of data. I always laugh. I make this joke. I said, if you go home at night and your wife says, honey, I'm happy in this marriage, do you need any more data? That one piece of data informs everything you need.
Right? Yeah, that one answer says it all, doesn't it?
And that's what I would do. And after visiting enough stores, you visit dozens and dozens of stores and things started to connect. They'd start saying the same things and you say, hey, maybe we should look at that. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe we should do this way. And that's how we learn. And it was the best information. It's 10 times better than doing big research projects.
Yeah. Is that practice something you had done in the past or learned from others? Or is that something that you started doing at Starbucks?
No, that was retail.
That was always your style.
I grew up with that.
Yeah.
That was what retail was like. When I grew up in retail, there were no computers. It was human beings. And so that was the way I did it. And it was the only way I knew. I wasn't smart enough to do it the other way.
So you mentioned that Howard Schultz was a big dreamer, and he wrote in the foreword to your book something to the effect of he was always trying to dream bigger dreams, and that you would take 5 steps back and think about what could go wrong. Even if it was your idea, you're a good editor or a good filter. Can you talk about that dynamic of the visionary versus the filter, or the visionary versus the editor, however you like to describe it? How did that look between the two of you?
So I'd prefer to call it the pragmatist. I was 10 years older than he was, right? I had run some pretty good sized companies at that point in time. And I'd been president of a land development company. I had run a chain of 60 furniture stores. So I had a feel for stuff. And I already knew things never go the way you want them to go. Howard always believed everything was going to go perfectly. He was a true believer about everything. And if he liked it, he was sure it was going to work. Well, that's not the way it was. So my very first week, I'm out on the stores. And I went to the store in Redmond that we had, one of the old stores. And I walked into the store, and behind the counter was this guy with a measuring tape. And I said, oh, what are you measuring for? He said, I'm measuring for soup. I said, soup? You're measuring for soup? Really? So I got on the phone with Howard right away. Now, remember, I'm just there a few weeks. I said, Howard, what are you doing? He says, well, we ought to have soup. I said, Howard, we can hardly serve our coffee. And you want to add soup? We're not a lunch counter. So that was our first blowout. Then, you know, Howard was the dreamer. He told me pretty early on, he says, someday we're going to have 100 stores in Manhattan. I said, are you nuts? 100 stores in Manhattan? He was so right. We got, I don't know how many hundreds of stores in Manhattan, 300-400 stores now in Manhattan. So it was that kind of difference. I always thought I just was old enough and raised differently, and the experiences that I had, that nothing ever went the way you wanted. I'd been with two companies that didn't make it. And I understood things can go wrong no matter how much you are a true believer. And so I was that counter, and so was Orrin Smith. We were both that side of it. On the other hand, when we finally realized what we had, we were as quick on the draw as Howard was in growing the business. There's conflicts. Howard and I had lots of conflicts about things. He didn't want non-fat milk. He didn't want Frappuccino. I think he still hates Frappuccino. And some things, he was more of a purist than I was. I was whatever, it's my deal was whatever that customer wants and whatever the baristas are telling me, as long as it's not illegal, immoral, or unethical, we're going to try it.
Yeah. How do you think people can be good in that role of pragmatist when they're working with a big dreamer? How do you do it effectively without being negative or always having to point out the flaws in ideas? What's the way to manage that dynamic?
Well, you can't. I wasn't like everything that we did or he said that I was pointing out the flaws. Probably 90% we did went with. It was the ones that stood out or the things that I truly believed in. Like he didn't want non-fat milk. Some things I just pushed. And I just said, you hired me to do this. Leave me alone. That's what I really pushed for. He wanted to be the CEO. He could be the CEO for everybody else. He wasn't going to be a CEO for me. I wanted a partnership. I wanted to be his partner. I wanted him to be my partner in the journey. Now, I had to perform. It couldn't be just talk. I had to perform. That's the number one thing. If you're going to challenge your boss, you damn well better produce. You don't get to challenge if you're not producing because you've lost credibility. I had a lot of credibility early on, and I built credibility quickly in the organization because I was producing. And I had a lot of people respected me. I had strong relationships inside the organization, so that really helped. And Howard respected me too. He was a street fighter. I wasn't that, but my temper would go up real quick. I had a short fuse on a lot of things, and we would argue like hell about things. He put up with me. To tell you the truth, I don't think anybody else could have done it. I think it was our unique personalities that combined together, along with Orrin Smith, who was the consummate peacemaker between the two of us, that made it work.
When you're talking to companies that you're investing in or advising, what are some of the lessons that you take away from that dynamic between you and Howard and Orrin that you think leadership teams can replicate or learn from?
You got to be brutally open and honest with each other, and you can't be thin-skinned. If there's going to be fights, you got to be able to battle it out together, and then you got to come out the other side unified, which we always did. No matter what the argument was, right, at the end of the day, we always came out unified on the other side, and that's an important part of it. I think we didn't plan the three of us. They called us H2O, and two Howards and an Orrin, and we knew where each other was on the court all the time. And we used to have dinners every Monday night, the three of us. And we would moan, we'd groan, we'd cry, we'd celebrate, whatever it was that was going on at the time. It enabled us to really know each other and to really understand each other and really support each other. And that made a huge difference. And I never felt that Howard didn't support me once in the whole time. And I think that's the key. I think leaders have to learn to do that. If you go out and you hire a great person, I always use this adage, the person who sweeps the floor should choose the broom. So Howard went out and hired me to be the VP of operations. So let me be the VP of operations. Let me make the decisions in my realm. If I screw it up, then I own it. And I either fix it or you boot my ass out. Now that nothing wrong with that. But you got to develop those kind of relationships. Every boss says, oh, we're going to do just fine here as long as you don't bring me any surprises. Except what they're talking about is they don't want any negative surprises. But if you came in with a $1 million order that they never thought they're going to guess, they love that surprise. The unfortunate part is you always are going to get both sides of that equation. So you got to have lots of room for that. And you got to have room for each other. And you got to be willing to try things. You have to be almost fearless. And we were fearless. Howard was fearless, really fearless. I was more that pragmatist, always a little bit worried, which is still made it to this day. And it was a combination of the three of us that made it work. Either one of the two, any of the two of us together wouldn't have worked. Howard and I would have killed each other. And Orrin and I would have had a nice business in Portland and Seattle. Orrin wasn't strong enough to handle Howard. And so the three of us made it work. It was just unique and it just happened accidentally. But I think you can do better. You can plan it out by really do your work on relationships and understanding each other before you hire somebody or put them in those kind of positions. I think you can head off a lot of it.
So I wanted to change gears, and I wanted to ask you about opening the first store in Japan when you went to run the international business. How did you end up choosing Japan, and what was that experience like taking the business international?
I was the one that pitched to the board that we should take Starbucks outside of North America. And we did the original business planning with my team and when I was still running the North American business. And so my pitch was to go to Europe and Asia and Europe simultaneously, that we'd start in the UK, which knowing what I know now, that would have been stupid if we'd have done it. And the board said, hey, pick your spot. We don't want to take that much risk. And I'd made a commitment to the company that I would have it cash flow positive within the first 5 years. And so after all the research I'd done, I came to the conclusion that we should go to Asia first because the Asian markets more adopt U.S. products faster than European markets do. And we did everything by joint ventures. So we weren't going to do it ourselves. We didn't have the resources to do it, and nor did we want to take that risk. And I started talking to people throughout Asia. I was gone. You know, my business trips were 3 weeks at a crack, visiting different Asian countries. And I met this group in Japan called Sazabi. And they had some restaurants and retail. And I just attached to them right away. I thought, these are good people. And so we started to build a relationship. And it took us about a year to do that. And they had a lot of company had sent us letters wanting to take Starbucks into their country. We had these files, and so they were in that file. And so I spent a lot of time with them, and I decided we're going to go to Japan first. And that's what I pitched the board, that we would go to Japan first. Now, everybody said they're not coffee drinkers, but all the research showed that they were big coffee drinkers. There are a lot of independent coffee stores called Kisaten where men would go in, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee. And there were some chains that had started up. And so I said, let's go first there. And we did. And we opened up the first store in Tokyo. In the shopping district and the Ginza area across from a department store called Mitsukoshi. And it had two floors, and I thought we were going to have smoking, which was totally Howard wanted to kill me for that. But everybody smoked. And I thought, there's no way we're not going to be able to have smoking in our stores and sell anything. So we had smoking upstairs, and I spent about $300,000 putting in this smoke removal system to keep the smoke out of the store. And so the first store we opened was smoke. After that, we didn't do it. We figured out we didn't have to do it. But that store, I remember the morning we were there, Howard was there, I was there, a whole group of us from Seattle. We were in Tokyo for the opening, and we were sitting across the street on this little ledge waiting for the store to open, waiting for customers to come in. It's 8 o'clock. Nobody shows up. 9 o'clock. Nobody shows up. Finally, about 10 o'clock, somebody shows up. It was two young guys. They walked into the store. I immediately rushed over. I was going to buy them their coffee. And I introduced myself, and they're both Japanese, but they're Japanese Americans from Seattle. So, our first customers were from Seattle, not from Tokyo. But by 11 o'clock that morning, we had a line around the block, and it stayed that way until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's how we entered Japan, and we started opening stores, and it was a blowout success. Everybody said they wouldn't drink out of paper cups. Because everybody wanted China cups. I said, no, they'll drink out of paper cups. And sure enough, and you know what would happen? You'd see these young people take their paper cups, take them outside. They'd hold the logo facing out as they're walking down the street because it was a fashion statement to them. Mm. I went to Starbucks, see me? And Starbucks Japan has been an enormous success. I think there's probably a couple thousand stores there now. It was highly profitable from the beginning. And then we rolled out from then. And I did it according to I didn't choose the country first. I chose the partner first. Mm. And I made some mistakes along the way, particularly in Singapore and Indonesia. I made some mistakes, chose the wrong partner, and it took us a while to get rid of some of them, but we finally did. But across Asia, Starbucks has been a blowout success. We opened our first store. We started selling coffee in China in 1996. Or 1995 wholesale, because I want to get the name registered there. And then we did a joint venture with the Chinese government and our Taiwanese partners to open stores in Beijing in the first market. And, you know, now there's, I don't know, almost close to 4,000 stores in China. It'll be the biggest market by far. It would not surprise me someday if there's 30, 40,000 stores in China.
What was it that you knew that everybody else didn't know that made you confident that they would drink out of paper cups and overcome some of those things that the naysayers said, oh, this won't work here in this market, or this is different? What was the belief that gave you conviction?
I had a hunch. It was we were going to drive towards young people, and young people are open to change, and the older people would come along after. And I've made probably a half a dozen trips there and stayed 4 or 5 days each time, just walking the streets, going into stores, looking what other people were doing, not just in the coffee business, trying to understand it. And our partners had confidence, which gave me confidence. So it was a combination of the two. We didn't know. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I knew. I didn't. But I knew that we could make adjustments if we needed to, and we did. We went in with what we knew, and then we started to adjust to what the market was asking for. And so we got really good at that. And I probably saw the first 50 pieces of real estate in Japan before we signed a lease, because I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be signed on to those. And so it wasn't like we had the answers. We did not. That would be the ultimate lie. We just knew that we could make it if we worked hard. And if it didn't work, we weren't going to blow up the company. I wasn't betting the company. That's why we did it with joint venture partners. We hardly put up any cash. In Japan, we were borrowing at 1%.
Wow. What were some of the adjustments that you remember making that were pivotal in being able to drive so much growth so quickly?
There were food adjustments. Our food business in Japan immediately started out at about 20%, where our food business in the States was about 7 or 8%. And then there were products. Like, we never had caramel, but they had it there. They had caramel was one of their favorite ice cream flavors. So we started with that. Then we did, when we introduced Frappuccino, we had Frappuccino made with green tea because that appealed to that market. And so we put products in there that fit the market. Now, but a latte was a latte. A mocha was a mocha. But other than that, we moved and we were willing to try things.
So you got this confidence and started to feel invincible. What was a humbling experience that happened as a result of that? Or where did what was one of those mistakes that happened that kind of said, oh, I need to come back down to earth?
So the two biggest mistakes I made in Asia were signing with the wrong partners. So in Indonesia, we signed with the biggest department store chain. In Singapore, we signed up with a guy that had a lot of real estate and he had the Burger King franchise. And I always believe that the number one thing that you had to look for were people skills. And I sucked into these two groups. They just didn't have the people skills. They cared about money more than they cared about people. And I didn't sense that. And so right out of the gate, we had problems. And in Singapore, it took us 8 years to get rid of that guy. And our business was dying in Singapore. We got him out, we took it back, and we ran it. Within 6 months, we doubled the volume. The only thing we did differently was we started respecting the people. That was it. The products were the same. The stores were the same. That's all we did. And we did the same thing in Indonesia. We took it back and bought them both back out. And there were battles to get them out. But those were the mistakes I made. I short-circuited. I read this a book about the CEO of Sony Japan. And he said, before you do any deal, take the deal, crumple it up, swallow it. If it gives you indigestion, don't do the deal. And that deal gave me indigestion. I did it anyway because I sucked into the real estate and I was in a hurry. I was sucked in. Japan's doing great. Let's get going.
So being in a hurry and wanting to move quickly.
Not really knowing the people well enough. And I was warned by a person about Singapore and I ignored the warning.
Well, it's interesting because you're so much about the people. And when you describe the partner in Japan, it was all about the relationship and connecting with them.
I thought I knew these people, but I didn't. You know.
So let's talk servant leadership a little bit, because you've written about this, you speak about servant leadership a lot. I feel like the term has become more popular or used in the business world. When did that term first become part of the way you talk and your business philosophy?
The first I'd ever heard of the term servant leadership was a guy that I reported to, a guy named Jim Jensen. And I was working at Grand Tree Furniture Rental, and he handed me this little pamphlet called The Servant is Leader. And it was written by a man named Robert Greenleaf, who coined the term. And he was the head of organizational development at AT&T in the 40s and 50s. And when he retired, he looked back at his career and he said, who are the leaders that after they left their organizations continued to blossom? And who are the leaders when they left their organizations caved in on themselves? And he came to the conclusion, the ones that really did well after their leaders left were the ones that their leaders intrinsically understood that their job was there to serve their people, not be served by their people. And it was the opposite of the ones that where the organizations caved in on themselves. And so I got that pamphlet and I read about it. And I acted like a servant leadership in a lot of cases, but I didn't have any words for it. I was an unconscious competent. It was my people skills that made it work and my caring about people. But I couldn't teach anybody. It was just Howard being Howard. And so I started to get interested in it. And that was in about 1975. And that began my journey in servant leadership. And then I got interested in it. And then I just was relentless in reading about it, trying things, practicing things, figuring out what works, what doesn't work, what's real, what isn't real. How do I make it my own? Because you got to make it your own. It can't be Robert Greenleaf's servant leadership. It had to be Howard Behar's servant leadership. I would talk to people that were servant leaders around the country that already had defined themselves as servant leaders and say, what is it? And so that's the journey that I got on. And I've been on that journey for 50 years.
What's changed about your definition and understanding of servant leadership in that study as you've gone deep over the last 50 years? What are some of the things that have most changed or evolved in your thinking on it?
I came to the conclusion over time that it wasn't just leadership, that servant leadership was a way of living. It wasn't just a way of operating an organization or a business. And that you had to combine, you had to understand that it was a holistic approach, not this is the way I'm at work, but I go home and I'm an asshole. It's who you are throughout your whole life. And that's what makes it work, because it's consistent. It's authentic. It's in all parts of your life. And then it becomes real to your people, and they see you as this kind of person with these kind of values, and you live those values and you act on those values. And that is the biggest change for me in the idea of servant leadership. It wasn't some manipulative way of getting something done in an organization. It was a way of living, and it had to be totally aligned with your values and had to be totally aligned with your actions.
You now have the benefit of hindsight of leading this way, seeing the alums of Starbucks go on to do great things, CEOs of good companies. Like, how does that show up in the long term? And now that you have the benefit of 30 years looking back, what are the signals that you see from your own experience that tell you, hey, this way has worked, or it's proliferated, or it's the world is moving this direction?
Yeah, I always believed in this equation: grow the people, grow the organization, and the organization grows the business. And so my whole goal in life was to grow the people, make better human beings out of our people, help them develop better skills, not through my own knowledge necessarily, but getting them the resources that they needed to grow. And that has proven itself out. A woman named Christine Day was the CEO of Lululemon in the early days. Remarkable job. Grew the business. Wendy Colley, who grew a grocery store chain. Kathy Linneman, who is the senior VP of operations for one of big restaurant chain back east. Just not tons of people that went out that left Starbucks. Michelle Goss, who is
Kohl's, right? CEO of Kohl's.
Yeah,
Kohl's, right?
Yeah. She came out of Starbucks.
I didn't realize she was a Starbucks alum too. Wow.
Yeah, she reported to me for a while. It shows that if you treat people well, it works. And that was my goal. I wanted people to leave Starbucks, because they were going to be the bridge builders to taking servant leadership outside of Starbucks. So if they got an opportunity, I'd pat them on the back and say, yay for you. How can I help you? How can I support you? Because that was the goal, was to grow the people. There are always more people that would come into the organization. That's, I think, at the end of the day, look, what are we all here to do? I think there's only one role any of us as human beings play, and that's server of people. It doesn't make any difference what your title is, what your role is. If you're a widget maker that makes widgets go into a printing press, the printing press gets sold to a publishing company, the publishing company produces books or magazines or newspapers to inform or entertain their customers. The lowly widget maker, supposedly the lowly widget maker, is serving other people. A doctor, lawyer, engineer, it's serving other people. That's what we're here to do. And if we do that well, then we get our piece of the action. Okay, we'll get rewarded for that. Doesn't mean you're going to be rich. It's not the point. It's not why you do things. You do things because they make you feel better about yourself, because you can grow as a human being. You can serve others. And so that's what I think is our role as leaders in life. And too many leaders are selfish. Too many leaders think it's all about them. Too many leaders think about what they can put in their own pocket. And you see it everywhere. You know, you see it everywhere. And I think it's a detriment to society. And look at Salesforce.com. Highly successful company. That guy is a servant leader. He is so good to his people. He cares about the society he lives in. I wish I could say that about a lot of other companies in Silicon Valley, but I can't.
Absolutely. I got to ask you before I do the rapid fire round, because you are so pithy with your quotes, and you're known for some of these things. Like you mentioned the earlier one, the person who sweeps the floor should choose the broom. Yeah. Only the truth sounds like the truth, which I love. And we're in the people business serving coffee. Have you always been that way, or is that something that you had to develop? Because I personally, at least hearing you, reading your book, the way that you're able to distill down the ideas behind servant leadership is so compelling. And I'm curious to ask you, is that just a natural skill that you've had, or how did you come to develop that?
I don't know the answer to that question. You know that I'm not
70 years of trying to be quotable.
Trying different things. What I know is that I need purpose to my madness. I just couldn't sell a piece of furniture without building a relationship with the people that I was selling the furniture to. I couldn't serve a cup of coffee without building a relationship. And I had to have purpose in my life. And that's how I live my life. How I do everything in my life, the first thing is everything has to have a purpose bigger than myself. And so that I had to simplify things for myself. Those things, a person who sweeps the floor should choose the broom. The way I started that is I when I was trying to buy my own company, I had made a list of things how I wanted to lead the company. And I wanted everybody to be able to vote in their own area of expertise. Everybody had their expertise, they should have a huge vote. And so I just changed that at Starbucks to something that was more meaningful to Starbucks. And I was trying to influence people. And so I was good at doing that. And they would just come into my head, or I would see something that was good. Like one of my favorite quotes is one I read in a book when I was, you go home and your wife unloads her day on you, and then you want to start giving her solutions to her problems. They don't like that, do they?
No, I'm still trying to figure that one out. Yeah.
Here's the quote that'll never let you forget what you're there to do. Compassionate emptiness. Two words. That's it. Compassionate emptiness. Being full of compassion for what your wife is telling you, but empty of solutions. And that's what your children want too. And so I would see something like that and I would make it part of me. I'd put it on my office wall and it would drive me. And that's still today. I still have those quotes on my office wall. And you can't win a negotiation like you can't win a marriage. Always reminded me of that. And I'm not here to win this argument. I'm here to figure out how we can work together.
I love those.
Or turn your fear into faith, which is an old Ray Kroc quote. When things are going bad, turn your fears into faith.
I love how it ties back to purpose and really just using those words to give some language to your purpose for yourself and for others and to be able to influence.
Language. And people remember stories. And those quotes are just little stories.
They are,
That they can remember, and I can remember.
You have some fun quotes for people who want to go pick up a copy of your book and also just look at some of your speeches or on the internet, other podcasts. You have some great quotes. I want to wrap up with the Supersonic Six, which is the rapid fire round, which gives you a chance to create more quotes, Howard.
Yeah, all right.
All right. Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I drink 3 cups a day, triple tall Americanos.
All right. Number two, what's one Seattle company that you're following or studying right now? So what's one Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
Convoy would be the answer.
Awesome. And we've had Grant Goodale, the co-founder, on the podcast.
And I'll give you a second one, Mod Pizza. Scott Mod Pizza. Alex Svensson, two fantastic people.
God, my kids love that place. Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
As always, Jim Senegal. I watch what he did at Costco and I've watched what he's done in his retirement. And he's an amazing guy. He was the epitome of servant leadership. He would never have called it that, but he's the one guy. I just love that guy. I have so much respect for him.
Number four, what's one thing Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub or a hub for entrepreneurship?
One thing. I think that Seattle as a whole has become coming to expect these successes and these companies coming here. And I think we better be damn careful about what we do and how we do it because it doesn't feel very welcoming now. And I think to be more welcoming, we shouldn't be known as the anti-business place. We should be known as the welcoming business place.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Learn about yourself. Figure out what your values are early on in your life. You can start it before 20, 15. What are your core values? How do you want to live your life? It's not a forever thing, but I have my 8 to 10 core values I've had written down since I was in my early 20s. I have a mission statement and I have my guiding principles that I live by. And I think learning about yourself, writing it down, if you don't know where you're going, any path will get you there. So know where you're going and how you want to get there. And then live your life according to that, whatever it is.
Number six, what's one thing you'd like our listeners to go do? Something you'd like them to check out, a cause, anything that you want people to go put their attention on?
I'm going to go back to what I just said. I wish that everybody would spend the time to carve out their 8 to 10 core values, human values that they want to live their life by. I think if we had better intentions in life, and more direction in life, we would be a lot kinder to each other. In a world where you can be anything, I want everybody to be kind.
Well, that's a great place to end this conversation. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Adam, thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.